This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Well, good evening. Today is the 30th of April, 2024. It's a Tuesday, and I'm Gary Hicks, and I'm here to read to you for the next hour and present to you the USA Today front page and related articles. Kind of an overcast day today, but we need the showers for our gardens, right? Let's see what we have to read today. First one that I'm going to read is drone attacks take on new urgency. Number one threat to U.S. troops abroad spurs $500 million request to bolster defenses. This article is written by Tom Van Den Broek, USA Today, and Washington. Drone attacks have become the number one threat to U.S. troops deployed abroad, prompting a $500 million urgent request to help erect defenses. Cheap, easy to use, and hard to defend against, drones toting explosives pose risks to troops akin to the IEDs that killed and wounded thousands of U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, according to senior military and U.S. officials and experts. It was one way to attack drone launched by Iranian-backed militants that killed three U.S. soldiers in January after slipping past defenses at their base in Jordan. This new weapon system, Senator Jack Reed, a Democrat, Rhode Island chairman of the Armed Services Committee, said in an interview, is cheap. It can be sophisticated in terms of its electronics to identify targets itself remotely and then attack. This is a new phase of warfare, and we have to get ready. And we are. Military officials described an intense effort to protect troops from drones with missiles, microwave radiation, and lasers. The Pentagon is receiving more than $500 million through a supplemental request to Congress to address the drone threat. President Joe Biden signed it into law on Wednesday as part of the $95 billion foreign aid package. Rapid changes in technology and tactics require the Pentagon to move quickly. And Michael O'Hanlon, a military analyst at the Brookings Institute, he favors a pool of funds to promote innovative and cheap defense that jams signals used to guide drones and killer drones to hunt down the enemies. They are a big menace, says O'Hanlon. The drone dilemma. Not long ago, the Pentagon dominated the sky over battlefields with drones like the Predator and the Reaper. Pilots operating the drones in an outpost in the Nevada desert launched Hellfire missiles on suspected militants in Afghanistan and Iraq. Troops on patrols in combat zones hurled small drones into the air to spy on movements of adversaries nearby. Look at the war in Ukraine through the lens of Twitter or X, and you'll see myriad examples of drones hovering over Russian tanks and dropping high explosives into an open hatch. Or a video feed from a one-way attack drone, many supplied by the Pentagon, hurtling after an armored vehicle and detonating on impact. The Pentagon's days as the lone drone superpower are long over, said the senior defense official who wasn't authorized to speak publicly. Law 2 is stopping the proliferation of the technology that makes drones smaller, lighter, stealthier, more powerful, and deadly. And the official said commercial drones and parts for them are readily available. The reality plays out from the Red Sea, where Iranian-backed Houthi militants fired drones at busy shipping lanes to Iran, which launched a wave of drones and missiles at Israel on Saturday. In both cases, virtually all the drones were destroyed before hitting their targets, but it takes an array of defenses and considerable expense to do so. A U.S. Patriot missile unit based in Iraq downed a ballistic missile headed towards Israel, and two squadrons of warplanes knocked down dozens of drones. A single Patriot missile interceptor cost about $4 million. The layered defense. Defense against drones can be simple as hiding from them and as complex as zapping them from the sky with a laser, and pretty much everything in between, said Army Major General David Stewart, who directs the Counter Unmanned Aircraft Systems Office. There is no silver bullet, and even exquisite capabilities like the Patriot may not be survivable against certain threats, Stewart said in an interview. You need a layered defense approach for troops at a remote base, a location known to enemies with attack drones. The first layer of defense would ideally stretch miles beyond the fort's walls. That invisible perimeter might stretch 10 miles from the gate, Stewart said, and it could involve weapons of electronic warfare that could spoof the drone into hitting a different target or cutting the link between the drone and its operator. The layer closer in might be using a microwave weapon that actually fries the innards of the drone, rendering it harmless. The Army has fielded prototype lasers in the Middle East. The commander of the Central Command acknowledged in testimony on Capitol Hill, Army General Eric Kurilla, apparently was referring to lasers mounted on an Army Stryker combat vehicle. A three-soldier crew can destroy drones with a laser at short range. The 50-kilowatt laser has had a success against a variety of drones, according to the Army reports cited in the Congressional Research Service. But challenges for the laser remain defending against the rockets, artillery, and mortars. Final layer requires shooting down the drone or steel on steel, according to Stewart. Weapons like the Coyote, which fires a small missile at drones, or machine guns to knock them down with a hail of bullets. Enemy tactics change constantly, Stewart said, making drones harder to locate and kill. We're seeing a rapid changing and evolving process there, whether it's flying faster or flying lower, or using different attack patterns, Stewart said. The attack that killed three soldiers and wounded 35 others in January occurred when militants apparently discovered a seam in the layered defense. Militants fired the one-way attack drone, which can be programmed to hit a target and doesn't require an operator to steer it. Defenders at the base may have mistaken it for a friendly drone, officials said, and it crashed into the soldiers' living quarters. In congressional testimony last month, Kurilla emphasized the threat from drones and the need for immediate solutions. The threat from swarms of drones, he said, will require an investment high-powered microwave to be able to zap them. Reed, in the interview, said a recent test in the Army's Fort Sill showed microwave weapons had a success downing swarms of drones. The ultimate goal, Kurilla told lawmakers, is a weapon that shoots a burst of energy at a drone and destroys it for about $2. The reality is that for now, an expensive missile is often the only answer. What's worse than not having that expensive missile shoot it down, he said, is hitting that $2 billion ship with 300 sailors on it. All right, next one on weight loss drugs and insurance. It's called Firms Cut Weight Loss Drugs from Coverage. Beneficiaries of costly treatments left in the lurch. This is written by Ken Altucker of USA Today. Kiana Price dropped 35 pounds after she started taking the weight loss medication Wegovy last year. The Greenville, North Carolina mother no longer gets winded climbing stairs. Her knee pain is gone, and perhaps most importantly to Price, who is pre-diabetic, her cholesterol and sugar levels have dropped, giving her hope that she can escape her family history of diabetes. But Price, who works at East Carolina University, worries that all her progress may be short-lived. North Carolina's health insurance program for state employees is reeling from the cost and widespread use of these prescription drugs. To cut costs, the state has discontinued coverage for the prescription weight loss medications Wegovy and Saxenda beginning April 1st. Price is now paying more than $1,300 out of pocket per month to continue on Wegovy. It's more than she can afford, which means that she's looking at discontinuing the life-changing medication altogether. It's like a slap in the face, said Price, who said she'll finish her remaining Wegovy doses by the end of the month. I'm just really nervous about all the progress I've made and what's going to happen when I'm not taking it anymore. Patients like Price are struggling to afford a blockbuster class of weight loss medications called GLP-1, glucagon-like peptide 1, in parentheses, receptor agonist. I'm just really nervous about all the progress I've made and what's going to happen when I'm not taking it anymore. They were initially used to treat diabetes, but drug makers have since won approval to market these drugs for weight loss and heart disease. More potential uses and lucrative pharmaceutical company sales are on the horizon as researchers study new ways to use the drugs. A late-stage study this month reported that diabetes and weight loss drug tirzepatide may also help treat sleep apnea for people with obesity. As the list of medical uses for the drug grows, more people are asking their doctors for a prescription for meds that can cost more than $10,000 per year. Meanwhile, employers and health insurance plans are attempting to slow runaway spending on their drugs, on these drugs. And insurers have imposed requirements such as prior authorization or step therapy, which mandates that people try less expensive drugs first. In some cases, employers and insurers are denying coverage altogether. Federal spending on weight loss drugs surges. Medicare, the federal health program for adults 65 and older, is prohibited by law from covering drugs for more than 2 in 5 Americans who are obese but otherwise do not have a serious risk factor. However, obese patients with diabetes or heart disease may qualify for coverage. The nonprofit health policy organization KFF estimates that 1 in 4 Medicare enrollees who are obese may be eligible for Wegovy to reduce their risk of heart attack or stroke. A KFF analysis found Medicare spending on 3 drugs, Novo Nordisk, Ozempic, and Relsus, and Eli Lilly's Mounjaro, surged from $57 million in 2018 to $5.7 billion in 2022. That figure did not include rebates or other discounts negotiated by pharmacy benefit managers. Federal spending on the drugs is likely to grow, experts said. If just 1 in 10 eligible adults take Wegovy to prevent heart attack or stroke, KFF estimated it would cost Medicare's Part D prescription drug coverage nearly $3 billion a year. The costs have increased so rapidly, even before Medicare plans are allowed to cover the drugs for weight loss, that the trajectory has raised concerns about the fiscal impact of broad coverage of GLP-1 drugs on Medicare, other health insurers, and patients, KFF said. The high list price, combined with the number of projected users among the state employees, was too much to sustain, North Carolina state officials decided. To continue to afford coverage of the drugs for weight loss, the state would have had to raise premiums to nearly $50 per month, for about 750,000 employees and their dependents covered by the state health plan. More than 23,000 people on North Carolina's health plan were using the prescription drugs for weight loss. The medication costs the state more than $800 per member per month on average, after rebates. The state treasurer projected the state's bill for the medication would soar to about $1 billion over the next 6 years. State Treasurer Dale R. Falwell and the state health plan this week formally asked the public for input on how the state can cover the drugs in a fiscally responsible way. All we're asking is to be treated fairly and not to be price gouged by the manufacturers. The state will continue to pay for GLP drugs such as Ozempic for diabetes patients. People who take the medication only to lose weight will now have to pay out of pocket. Novo Nordisk, the Danish drug maker that sells the weight loss drug Wegovy, blasted North Carolina's decision to halt coverage of its weight loss drugs. In a statement, Novo Nordisk said the company was surprised and disappointed. Officials overseeing the North Carolina State Health Plan have rejected multiple workable options. State health plan officials are abandoning their obligation to employees living with a chronic disease of obesity and denying them coverage for the safe and effective treatments, the drug maker said. Denying patients insurance coverage for important and effective FDA-approved treatments is simply irresponsible. It's also cutting into their margin. North Carolina workers can't afford their premiums, to double. State employees and their families face a difficult situation if they can't shoulder the cost of the drugs, said the union representative to state employees. Teachers and the police officers, correctional officers, they can't afford for their premiums to be doubled, said Artis Watkins, executive director of the U.S. of the State Employee Association of North Carolina. Watkins said that it was essential what would happen in North Carolina continued to cover the medications. Raleigh resident Traylene Williams exercises daily and runs half marathons, but she credits Wegovy with reducing her cravings, speeding her metabolism, and helping her shed more than 30 pounds. It's a miracle drug, said Williams, who works for the technological arm of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Unable to afford the more than $1,300 it'll cost to refill her Wegovy prescriptions, she worries what will happen when she runs out of medication. She's taking the drug every other week instead of on a weekly basis, her doctor prescribed. I'm just worried about gaining my weight back, Williams said, who added that she does not believe other weight loss options offered by the state are as effective as the medication she's currently taking. Employers don't really have a choice. Employers who provide health insurance for working-age Americans and their families also are struggling with the cost of these medications. A survey by the benefits consultant Mercer cited the sharp increase in the use of GLP-1 drugs, showing that it correlated with an 8.4% increase in employer prescription drug spending last year. While employers largely cover GLP-1 drugs for diabetes, companies have been slower to cover these medications for weight loss. Mercer's survey said 41% of employers with large staffs covered these drugs for obesity, and an additional 19% of large companies were considering such coverage. Some employers are beginning to implement programs that require workers to try other weight loss strategies before qualifying for GLP-1 drugs. Others are imposing strict limits for patients to qualify for these drugs, such as minimum body mass index thresholds that would allow coverage only for people who are severely obese. If money wasn't an issue here, then certainly every employer would cover the drugs, said James Gelfand, president and CEO of the ERISA Industry Committee, which represents companies that provide employee benefits. There are aspects of these drugs that are miraculous, but at the same time, the price is so egregious, and the U.S. is beginning being treated so badly, so much worse than the rest of the world. Employers don't really have a choice. They just can't let it be open season. Drug makers often launch drugs at higher prices when they have the exclusive right to sell medications before generic companies offer competing versions. Drug makers say that the price drugs to recoup years of research and development costs. They often also must pay lucrative rebates to drug pricing middlemen to get access to customers. But the prices for the weight loss drugs are too high, according to some. A study from Yale University found that weight loss medications that retail for more than $1,300 a month cost just $22 to make. Senator Bernie Sanders blasted the Danish drug maker Novo Nordisk this week for charging U.S. residents far more than the diabetes drug Ozempic and the weight loss drug Wegovy than the companies charge for the same medications in their other nations. In a letter Wednesday to Novo Nordisk's top executive, Sanders questioned why the company charges Americans far more for Wegovy, noting that the same drug can be purchased for $140 in Germany and $92 in the United Kingdom. The scientists of Novo Nordisk deserve great credit for developing these drugs that have the potential to become a game changer for millions of Americans struggling with type 2 diabetes and obesity. As important as these drugs are, they will not do any good for millions of patients who can't afford them. Sanders added that if Novo Nordisk prices for these drugs are not substantially reduced, they have the potential to bankrupt Medicare, Medicaid, and our entire healthcare system. The United States Congress and the federal government cannot allow that to happen. In the meantime, prices are extremely high for out-of-pocket purchases. Employers can't wait for price discounts, and drug makers have little incentive to offer price concessions as demand soars. Top-selling injectable drug semaglutide, sold as Wegovy and Ozempic, is also facing a shortage, according to the Food and Drug Administration. For now, employers and insurers are adopting stricter tools, such as prior authorization to ensure patients use the drugs appropriately, said Eileen Pinkay, a national pharmacy practice leader at Seagull, a benefits consultant. Pinkay said that employers don't want to pay for weight loss medication if their employees are seeking it for lifestyle purposes such as quick weight loss. That's why insurance plans require patients to meet strict criteria, and many employers pair this with services such as teaching proper nutrition and exercise. Employers know a lot of members may be using it for off-label use. Maybe they want to lose 20 pounds before they go to a wedding, said Pinkay. Makes you wonder what money is being saved by lowering people's weight and taking them off of diabetes or the side effects of diabetes. That might balance it out. But we will find out in the future, won't we? Israel is negotiating or talking about a truce plan. Blinken urges Hamas to accept truce plan. Secretary, proposal extraordinarily generous. This is written by Humayra, H-U-M-E-Y-R-A, Pamuk, and John Irish. This is out of Reuters. Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged Hamas on Monday to swiftly accept Israel's latest and extraordinarily generous proposal for a Gaza truce to secure a release of hostages amid a diplomatic drive to end the war between Israel and Hamas. Hamas negotiators were expected to meet in Qatari and Egyptian mediators in Cairo on Monday to deliver a response to the phased truce proposal Israel presented at the weekend ahead of the threatened Israeli assault on the southern border city of Rafah. The only thing standing between the people of Gaza and the ceasefire is Hamas. They have to decide, and they have to decide quickly, Blinken said. At a special meeting of the World Economic Forum in the Saudi capital of Riyadh. I'm hopeful that they will make the right decision. A source briefed on the talks said that Israel's proposal entailed to accept the release of fewer than 40 of the roughly 130 hostages believed to be still held in exchange for freeing Palestinians jailed in Israel, and a second phase of a truce consisting of a period of sustained calm. Israel's compromise response to Hamas demand for permanent ceasefire. Blinken arrived in Saudi Arabia on Monday, the first stop and the latest of a series of troubleshooting trips to the Middle East since the Gaza war ignited in October. Blinken reiterated that the U.S. could not support an Israeli ground assault on Rafah, where Israel says Hamas' last four intact battalions are holed up. In the absence of an Israeli plan to ensure that civilians will not be harmed. He said the U.S. and Saudi Arabia had done intensive work together over the past few months towards a normalization accord between the kingdom and Israel, a deal that includes Washington giving Riyadh agreements on bilateral defense and security commitments, as well as nuclear cooperation. Diplomats said the eruption of the Gaza war derailed progress towards Israeli-Saudi normalization. The U.S. and Saudi components of the agreement are potentially very close to completion, Blinken said. To move forward with normalization, two things will be required: calm in Gaza and a credible pathway to the Palestinian state. In return for normalization, Arab states are also pushing for Israel to accept a pathway to Palestinian statehood on land it captured in the 1967 Middle East War, something Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has repeatedly rejected. Hamas fighters attacked Israel on October 7th, killing 1,200 people and seizing 253 hostages, according to Israeli tallies. Israel retaliated by imposing a total siege on Gaza, then mounting an air and ground assault that killed more than 34,000 Palestinians, according to health authorities in Hamas-ruled Gaza. Palestinians have been suffering from severe shortages of food, fuel, and medicine amid the Israeli offensive, which has demolished much of the impoverished, densely populated strip. Blinken, speaking earlier at an opening of a meeting with Gulf Arab states, said that the most effective way to address the crisis and create space for more lasting solution was to get a ceasefire that allowed the release of hostages held by Hamas. He is expected to discuss with Arab foreign ministers what the governance of Gaza might look like after the Israel-Hamas war ends, according to the senior State Department official. Blinken also is expected to bring together Arab and European countries and discuss how Europe can help reconstruction in Gaza, which has been reduced to a wasteland in a six-month-long Israeli bombardment. We will discuss the hostages, humanitarian situation, and ceasefire. Things are progressing, but we must always remain prudent in these discussions and negotiations, French Foreign Minister Stephanie Séjourné told Reuters on Monday. Jordanian Prime Minister Bashir al-Kashwani, said all parties needed to find a path towards a two-state solution to the conflict or the Middle East risk another catastrophe. An assault on Rafah, which Israelis say is the last Hamas stronghold in Gaza, has been expected for weeks, but foreign governments and the United Nations have expressed concern that such an action would result in a humanitarian disaster given the number of displaced people crammed into the area. Conversations about Gaza's rebuilding and governance have been going on for months with a clear mechanism yet to emerge. The United States agrees with Israel's objective that Hamas needs to be eradicated and cannot play a role in Gaza's future. But Washington does not want Israel to reoccupy the enclave. Instead, it has been looking for a structure that will include a reformed Palestinian Authority, which exercises limited self-rule in the Israeli-occupied West Bank with support from Arab states. Well, just to remind you, you're listening to Radio Reading Services of Cincinnati. And I'm broadcasting from my home on the Little Miami River. My house is 12 feet up off the ground with a cinder block basement all around it. And a big old 20-foot long porch looks out on the river. So I'm like living in a park down here on the river, just east of Newtown. Let's see here. Let me take a sip and a little break to... All right, let's see here. We got an article here about escape from Gaza. We've talked about Blinken urging Hamas. Why not talk about Mr. Trump? What to expect from Trump's trial this week? Transcripts available from last week's events. And this was written by Kinsey Crowley, USA Today. Former President Donald Trump's hush money trial was on a break on Monday. But a court will reconvene this morning. Although the jurors and lawyers typically gather on Monday mornings, Judge Juan Merchan ruled last week that there would be no proceedings. Monday was part of the last 2 days of the Jewish holiday of Passover. Court also let out early on April 22nd and 23rd to allow people to travel for religious gatherings. Trump faces 34 counts of falsifying business records to disguise the hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels that allegedly constituted an illegal campaign contribution. Here's what we know as Trump's trial continues into week 3. Trump trial schedule. The trial is expected to last 6 to 8 weeks, according to media advisory. Proceedings typically start at 9:30 a.m. local time and run through the business day. Court is on break on Wednesdays. Trial is not televised, but you can read transcripts. New York City Criminal Court is publishing the trial transcripts and copies of evidence shown to the jury. Transcripts of proceedings aren't always available, but officials decided to make them available because of unparalleled public interest. Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday's transcripts are available now on the New York State Unified Court Systems media website. Evidence shown to the jury, including texts, emails, and photos, also are available from last week's proceedings. Week 2 ended during a third witness testimony. Jurors heard from three witnesses last week. David Pecker, former head of the National Enquirer's parent company, testified about how he used the publication to write positive stories about Trump and prevent negative stories about him from coming out during the 2016 presidential campaign. His testimony and cross-examination spanned 3 days. He also said his editor-in-chief believed Stormy Daniels' story about an alleged sexual encounter in 2006, which Trump denies. Trump's former executive assistant, Rona Graff, made a brief appearance on the witness stand on Friday. When court wrapped up for the week, the prosecution was questioning Gary Farrell, former senior managing director at First Republic Bank. Farrell, who was former Trump lawyer's Michael Cohen's banker in 2016, could be used to bring in email evidence about the payment to Daniels. CNN reported Cohen used money from his home equity line to cover Daniels' payment, and email from a First Republic Bank employee confirming the transfer. Leaving the courthouse on Friday, Trump challenged President Joe Biden to a debate. "We'll do it at the White House," Trump said. "That would be very comfortable, actually." Okay. Well, I think so far President Biden has agreed. So we'll see what comes out of that. And there's also been quite a few demonstrations this past week or so at the universities located in New York. This article relates to that. Talks failed to bring standoff to conclusion at Columbia. Students, faculty defy deadline to vacate camp. Bunch of people wrote on this article. John Bacon, Eduardo Cuevas, Jorge Ortez, and Sibel May Osterman. Looks like they all write for USA Today. New York. Columbia University ordered pro-Palestinian protesters to disband their encampment on campus Monday after school representatives and student organizers failed to negotiate a resolution of the standoff, but students remained in place after the 2 p.m. EDT deadline for clearing out. "Regretfully, we are not able to come to an agreement," school president Manoush Shafiq said in a statement on Monday. Standoff at Columbia, which has fueled similar protests on campuses across the nation, began almost 2 weeks ago. Protesters demand the school halt investments with companies profiting from Israel's war in Gaza. They want amnesty for students and faculty involved in the protest. Shafiq said the university offered to convene a faculty committee to address academic freedom, create an expedited timeline for reviewing socially responsible investing, and to invest in health and education in Gaza. But she also said that external actors had contributed to creating a hostile environment that drove some Jewish students and others to leave the campus. She said the school will not divest from Israeli companies and will proceed with its graduation ceremony set on May 15th. Ultimatum issued and ignored. After negotiations reached an impasse, the school on Monday issued a notice to the protesters asking them to please promptly gather your belongings and leave the encampment by 2 p.m. If they identify themselves to a university official and sign an agreement to abide by all university policies, they would be eligible to complete the semester in good standing. John Ben Menachem, one of the main student organizers, posted on social media platform X that members of the Gaza Solidarity encampment face mass evictions and interim suspensions if they don't leave. The Columbia Students for Justice in Palestine posted, "Do not sign anything with administration. Show up at noon to protect the encampment. We will not move until Columbia meets our demands or we are moved by force," the group said in a news release. Students began gathering midday for a rally ahead of the university's 2 p.m. deadline to clear out or face suspension. "No business as usual," they chanted. "This is only one solution, an intifada revolution." Faculty members donning orange safety vests join students in a rally near the encampment. "We salute you and we stand with you," Shanna Redman, a professor of English and comparative literature, told the crowd from a megaphone. "And we're so proud to be your professors." Chris Carr, a doctoral student in astronomy, who came by Monday to lend his support, called the protest a beautiful display of community and said it would not be a good idea to have police break it up again. Seems like every time that they try to inflict force on us through public safety or through the NYPD, the students come out stronger and stronger than ever. He said that they can try, but I think that the students are strong and united on that. U.S. students not alone in protest. The U.S. students are not alone in protesting the war in Gaza, while students at the University of Georgia set up a Gaza solidarity encampment on Monday morning. Demonstrators at Paris's Sorbonne University were chanting Free Palestine at the university's gates as some students set up tents in the courtyard. Video from the Shabura refugee camp in the southern Gaza city of Rafah show signs in support of the protests, CNN has reported. Some read, students of Columbia University continue to stand by us, and thank you, students, in solidarity with Gaza. Your message has reached us. At George Washington University in Washington, D.C., less than a mile from the White House, protesters took down barriers and expanded a pro-Palestinian campus. Protests stretched into the fifth day Monday and the last day of spring semester classes. There's clearly a lot of pressure from the university and the university police for us to leave because we're being too disruptive. And we're being disruptive because there cannot be business as usual during a genocide, said Miriam Siegel, 19, a sophomore from nearby Georgetown University. And Reuters also contributed to that article. Let's talk about the weather. Big storms batter Gulf Coast as the East bakes. This is written by Christopher Kahn and Claire Thornton and Doyle Rice, USA Today. States along the Gulf Coast were under severe weather threats on Monday as a storm system that spun up ferocious tornadoes across the central U.S. over the weekend, killing at least four people and inflicting widespread damage, moved over the region. Elsewhere, record heat was possible along the East Coast, forecasters said, as temperatures approached above 90 degrees in the mid-Atlantic. Powerful thunderstorms rolled across southeast Texas and southwest Louisiana through the morning Monday and into the afternoon, raising the threat of damaging wind gusts, large hail and flash floods with up to 2 inches of rain falling every hour in some areas, according to the National Weather Service. The worst of the heavy rain and thunderstorms was expected to be offshore by the evening. In Houston, commuters were forced to navigate floodwaters that overtook roads, according to the State Transportation Department. Several school districts in Texas and Louisiana canceled classes or delayed the first bell by at least an hour on Monday, citing extreme forecasts. In Shreveport, the Louisiana State Exhibit Museum was closed because of severe weather. As of Monday afternoon, more than 48,000 homes and businesses were without power in Texas and Louisiana as the storms passed over the region, according to the USA Today database. Thousands in Oklahoma and Arkansas also have no power after a series of storms ripped through the central U.S. over the weekend. Flooding around Houston. The National Weather Service in Houston warned on X, formerly Twitter, that roads were closed after floodwater swept through the region. As you head out this morning, be aware that there are several roadways closed or almost impassable due to flooding. Authorities in the eastern corner of the Lone Star State posted a photo to social media on Monday morning showing floodwaters in the town of Lufkin, and that had overtaken a pickup that appeared to be abandoned in between lanes of the highway. about 35 miles east of Houston in the coastal town of Cove. Waters flooded highways, disrupted northbound and southbound travel, transportation officials said. Other areas surrounding Houston reported a high risk of roadway flooding, and authorities urged motorists to avoid unnecessary travel. Unusual heat in the east. While much of the central and southern U.S. continued to deal with severe weather, potentially record-breaking heat was forecast to overspread much of the east, according to forecasters. Temperatures will be well above the average among much of the East Coast this week, with Monday being the warmest of the bunch, said the National Weather Service. There's a chance for several stations in the mid-Atlantic to tie the break high temperature records today and tomorrow, with highs in the 80s and low 90s. The record high of 91 in Washington, D.C. could be a challenge, AccuWeather said. Temperatures may also come within a few degrees of 90 in Philadelphia and Baltimore this week. And recovery efforts are underway. Recovery began on Monday in cities and communities across the central U.S. after a few days of record tornado warnings in a region where the slow-moving storm system unleashed dozens of tornadoes that flattened entire streets, tossed cars, and killed at least four people, including a four-month-old baby in Oklahoma. The National Weather Service issued scores of tornado warnings on Friday and Saturday, and the Weather Service offices in Omaha, Nebraska, and Norman, Oklahoma, set their respective records for the most number of tornado warnings in a day, 42 and 59 respectively, according to NBC meteorologist Catherine Proseff. More than 100 people were injured in the storms, Oklahoma's Office of Emergency Management reported on Sunday afternoon. City of Sulphur, about 80 miles southeast of Oklahoma City, has had definitely the most damage since I've been governor, Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt said in a news conference. I've seen a lot of damage and I've been around the state, Stitt said. This is my sixth year, but what I saw in downtown Sulphur Springs is unbelievable. Stitt declared a state of emergency to free up money for recovery, and federal authorities, including the Federal Emergency Management Agency, were coordinating with state officials. Other states lashed by the storms include Nebraska and Iowa, where businesses and homes were destroyed. Four people were killed in Oklahoma. At least four people across Oklahoma were killed in tornadoes that ravaged rural communities and small towns throughout the state. The Oklahoma Medical Examiner has confirmed three storm-related fatalities, two in Holdenville, about 80 miles southeast of Oklahoma City, and one in Marietta, a small city near the Texas border. Hughes County authorities confirmed one of the victims was a four-month-old child and the other an adult male. Stitt announced a fourth fatality in Sulphur, a city of about 5,000 people, where the tornado tore through the downtown strip. We'll do whatever we can to help put the pieces back together, Stitt said. Thank goodness it was in a downtown, that there wasn't a lot of people there at 10:30 at night. You just can't believe the destruction. More storms are on the way. A low-pressure system is expected to bring showers and thundershowers across the Great Plains and Mississippi Valley on Tuesday, according to Weather Service. Very large hail, strong gusts, winds, and few tornadoes are the primary threats, which may be felt in Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, South Dakota, and Minnesota. And those record high temperatures are right near Washington, D.C., and New York, and Columbia University. So things are going to get hot. Supreme Court says Trump aide Navarro must stay in jail. This is by Maureen Grope, USA Today. Washington, the Supreme Court on Monday, rejected former Trump advisor Peter Navarro's request that he be released from prison while he appeals his conviction for contempt of Congress. It was the second time the court declined to keep Navarro from serving his four-month sentence. Navarro was locked up on March 19th after Chief Justice John Roberts said he saw no reason to disagree with the lower court decision, denying Navarro's request to remain free on appeal. 15 days later, Navarro's lawyers asked the court to reconsider Roberts' decision. Lawyers pointed out that Navarro's appeal would be not heard until after he had completed his sentence. He's serving his time at a Federal Bureau of Prisons satellite camp for elderly male inmates in Miami. Navarro was convicted in September for refusing to testify or provide documents to the House committee that investigated the January 6th Capitol attack. Navarro, a former trade advisor, has maintained that he couldn't cooperate with the House inquiry because former President Donald Trump has asserted executive privilege to keep their communication confidential. But U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta found no evidence Trump did that. Even if Trump had, Mehta ruled Navarro was obligated to appear before the committee to refuse to answer specific questions. Navarro had argued he should remain free while appealing because he's not likely to flee the country and poses no public threat to public safety. He also said he was raising issues in his appeal that could overturn the conviction, including what constitutes a proper invocation of privilege, executive privilege. The January 6th committee wanted to question Navarro because he wrote in his 2021 book, In Trump and Time, about the scheme to delay certification of the President Joe Biden's election. Navarro described the scheme as the Green Bay sweep and said it was the last best chance to snatch a stolen election from the Democrats' jaw of deceit. Navarro said in an interview later that Trump was on board with the strategy, according to the committee. Another former Trump aide, political strategist Steve Bannon, also refused to cooperate with the committee. He was convicted of contempt of Congress and sentenced to 4 months in jail, but he remains free on appeal. Yeah, equal justice under the law, right? Okay, I got through my hour of reading. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope it was informative. Wish you all a safe and healthy week to come. And this is Gary Hicks signing off for Radio Reading Services of Cincinnati. Good night.